I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. 3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern with Scott Reeder, Suspect Convictions creator. For almost 20 years, Masuk Nolan Hwang has been the alternate suspect presented by the defense in the 1998 murder of 3-year-old Christina McNeil of Bloomington, Illinois. Masuk is serving a 55-year sentence for murdering her mother-in-law, Linda Tida, in 2011. The murder of Tida prompted prosecutors to reevaluate the evidence presented in Barton McNeil's trial. And it has the Illinois Innocence Project demanding his freedom. But one of the persistent mysteries of the case is, who is Masuk? Scott sought out those who know Masuk best to learn more about her. Scott, what did you discover?
This is an incredibly complex person. I found her to be an absolutely fascinating person to look at and just to try to get an idea of what her motivations were. I mean, this is somebody we know went on to kill somebody. We don't know if she was involved in the death of Christina, but we do know that she went on to kill her mother-in-law. So I wanted to find out, you know, what were her life experiences that led up to this incredible tragedy?
Because she was born and raised in South Korea.
That's correct. She married an American serviceman who was stationed in South Korea and came to the United States.
So you're talking about Andy Nolan, an American soldier who was stationed near the demilitarized zone in South Korea in the 1980s when they met. He is from Haworth, Illinois, and apparently they took to each other pretty well.
Well, you're from this area. Why don't you tell folks, you know, since we've got an international audience here, a little bit about Haworth.
Haworth is a very small community. I don't know the exact population, but it's probably in the hundreds, more than 1,000, I think. Maybe it's 1,000. It's located about 11 miles south of Bloomington, Illinois. And as we've said before, Bloomington Normal is in central Illinois, about halfway between Chicago and St. Louis. But Haworth is definitely your quintessential rural Midwestern community. Everybody knows everybody. You know, they run into each other at the grocery store. Everybody knows everybody's business. So that's kind of where Andy Nolan is coming from, that kind of a community.
And that's where Masuk ended up.
Well, I met Masuk in 1987. It was actually through a friend. And anyway, we had a couple dates and we hit it off and we done the paperwork, got married. She came over 6 months after that I ETS, which was my term was finished. And so she came over, and shortly after that, we got married.
Okay, so she came over on a fiancé visa or something?
Yes.
So a friend set you up.
He was a soldier down the street, and he was marrying her sister.
Okay.
So that's the connection. Two compounds, one about 100 yards down the street, okay, which is an air defense artillery unit, and that's where this gentleman was stationed. So him and I were friends, so he set me up with his wife's sister. Well, soon-to-be wife's sister.
This is a bit of a stereotype, but my understanding is there's a lot of Korean women that want to marry servicemen.
It's not Korean. It's wherever, what country you go to. Everybody, not everybody, but there's a lot of them that want to get out of their way of living. So many people think the American way is, you know, the best way, and, you know, they're wanting to get out of. I mean, Korea's a third world country. They fall in love, sure, they want to get out of there. So, but anyway, it don't make a difference if it's Korea, Japan, wherever. There's always, you know, women or even men there looking to marry, you know, whether it's a female soldier or a male soldier.
That's Andy Nolan of Haworth, Illinois, who was stationed in South Korea as an American soldier in the late 1980s when he met Masuk, and they married and created a life in Haworth, Illinois. Nearly 100,000 Korean women have married American servicemen since the Korean War began back in 1950. Their plight has been the subject of study for Northwestern University history professor Ji Yun Ya, who authored the book Beyond the Shadow of Camp Town, Korean Military Brides in America. Scott, you chatted with Professor Ya a little bit about many facets of the relationship between American soldiers and some of their South Korean brides. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what she had to say.
She interviewed many, many brides over decades, and she found some commonalities that I think would fit Ms. Sook as well. Often these are people that have had really bad relationships, perhaps have been the subject of some sort of abuse, who have had perhaps difficulty finding somebody to marry within the Korean culture. There's a lot of things here that were just fascinating that seem to overlap with what we know about Ms. Sook.
Korean women who marry American servicemen among themselves are a fairly diverse group, but when compared to South Koreans as a whole, they do have some distinctive characteristics. One is that they tend to come from a rural or small town areas near the bases, and they tend to be of working class or lower middle class origin, and they tend to have relatively low educational levels. Additionally, this is not for all of them, but anecdotally for a significant proportion of them, there's a fairly high proportion of incidents of abuse in their past life, abuse or trauma, often related to their experiences with men. So either with men who made promises and deserted them, or men who molested them or abused them or raped them. And often what that means is that the women sort of feel that either men are not trustworthy, in particular Korean men are not trustworthy, or that somehow they are no longer suitable for marriage within South Korea.
That's Northwestern University history professor Ji Yun Ya, who authored the book Beyond the Shadow of Camp Town, Korean Military Brides in America. Ms. Sook's marital options may well have been limited. Her father was opposed to her marrying a middle-aged man who had impregnated his daughter. Yeram Van Aki, the person born of that pregnancy, described the situation as bleak for her mother, and she detailed that information to you, Scott, in a phone call from Holland.
It was really bleak. I mean, she described a situation where both her partner's family and she, her family, were very much opposed to a marriage. A very difficult situation all the way around. It's worth noting, too, Willis, that Ms. Sook hasn't been available to us to clarify any of these things that have been said. So there's sometimes some disparity in what has been said. But one story that really stands out that her birth daughter shared was this heart-wrenching tale.
They met at a call center, and they dated or something in secret. And then, accidentally, she got pregnant of me, which is so nice to hear, of course. And, well, you know, it can happen. That they could not marry because both the families were against it because he was so much older. And, well, it's Korea in 85, so I thought, well, that's a good story. And that grandpa was so embarrassed and angry that he was against the pregnancy, but also against the marriage, that he kicked her out of the house and cut all her hair off.
So he cut off all of her hair. Scott, that seems to me like a very unusual way of disciplining your adult child, no matter what country you live in.
Yeah, I thought it was bizarre. I'd never really heard of that. I mean, I guess I'd heard stories about, after World War II, women who collaborated getting their hair cut. But, I mean, I'd never heard about that used as a form of punishment. So I talked to Professor Ya at Northwestern. She's a Korean-American, and she's done, obviously, a lot of studies. And ask her if she'd ever heard anything like this.
That's actually a fairly common shaming exercise in the more conservative segments of not just Korean culture, but other cultures where a woman's long hair is a sign of her femininity and status.
Had you ever heard of that within Korea?
Yes, I have. Not as if it was actually done. I've actually never heard a story of that actually being done. I've heard stories of it being threatened to be done.
You know, Willis, one of the things that I hear that story that struck me is when I talked to Masuk's ex-husband, Andy Nolan, a lot of the things he shared about Masuk's background fit very well with the work that Dr. Ye has done as far as characteristics common among military brides from Korea. What was she living like? I mean, I saw on one of the programs your daughter said that she had a pretty rough life growing up.
Well, it's not really financially rough, but what it was is her mother died when I believe she was 4 or 5. Her mother died of tuberculosis. So her sister was maybe 2. And so anyway, they bounced back and forth. After her mother died, you know, to living with her dad and living with the aunt and uncle. And when she was living with those kids were kind of like Cinderella, basically. They did all the housework, they did everything, and her cousins didn't have to do really anything. So when it come time for ice cream or treats or whatever, Mizuk and her sister, they didn't get any. And the little cousins, roughly the same age, they would sit there and eat in front of them. So she had a pretty well rough childhood. She was married to an older Korean gentleman. Her father did not approve of it whatsoever because the guy was roughly her dad's age. And now Mizuk had to been 18, 19, somewhere around there, got pregnant. They were married. She goes to the hospital, deliver the child, and what was it, the next day after, she's waiting to bring the baby to the room, and the baby's gone. Okay, her ex-husband sold their child to a couple in the Netherlands. Back in those days, you could do this stuff. A lot of things go on in third world countries that people don't realize. It's not America. And so anyway, could you imagine your daughter, you're waiting to see her, you just give birth the day before, and the medical staff comes in and says, sorry, we can't find your baby. What would you do?
But Scott, that question that he asked there, what would you do, that's rhetorical in nature right here. But we do have to kind of pause, I think, and decide what this event in Masuk's life does for her behavior going forward. This is obviously a traumatic event, if that's what happened. But how does that foretell her future behavior? Does something like this could explain it, but does it excuse some of the things she did later on in life?
Well, I don't think it can excuse, but I think, you know, the very basic question we're asking is, did this screw her up? Did this really mess it with her mind to the point that she eventually went on to kill her mother-in-law, and it's been suggested maybe somebody else? We don't know. We're looking at Masuk's life so that we can get a little bit better understanding of what she went through and the traumas she experienced so that we can have a little bit better understanding of what motivated her.
And there is some dispute as to whether or not it actually unfolded the way Andy Nolan just described it. Now, we already heard from Yaram Vanaki, the child that Masuk gave birth to back in Korea when she was either married or in a relationship with this older gentleman. Yet her version of the way things unfold is a little bit different than what Andy detailed, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, perhaps Masuk told different stories to different people. I don't have the identity of the father in Korea. I'm told he doesn't speak English, so I can't reach out to him to find out if there's any truth to this or not. We really don't know, but we know we can the gist of what we're getting from both the daughter and the ex-husband was she gave up a child that she wanted to keep.
And we know this because Yaram Vanaki, 31 years old, living in Holland today, actually did search for Masuk many years ago, went to Korea and came to the United States and found her and did actually get to know her somewhat.
Yeah, she visited here in the States twice with her mother, her birth mother, I should say. First time she came over with her adopted mother from Holland and visited. And then the second time she came over and visited Masuk by herself.
So let's find out now a little bit about the version of the story that was told to Yoram Ben Aki about the details of her birth.
Oh, the selling part is new to me.
Okay.
But she told me that she was in a clinic or hospital, but she said a cheap clinic, and that my birth father, I don't know why exactly, she didn't explain, but that he wanted the birth to be happening sooner than necessary, 2 months early, because I was born probably about 2 months early.
Why?
The doctor in Holland, the physician in Holland checked me out and said, oh, she's born at least too early, and Misuk made it or told me 2 months, didn't know why, but and that the birth was
induced
with some kind of medicine or something, and that after the birth my father would give her all kinds of hospital papers and then sneakily put in the adoption papers, which she didn't know, so she didn't know about adoption at all. And then woozy from all the meds and the birth, signed the adoption papers without knowing. And then that she was very sorry about it, and after 4 months she knew where to find me in which children's orphanage, and that she went to find me, but I was already in Holland.
Now, Scott, that was the child that was born to Masuk in Korea back in sometime in the 1980s, and about 1985, I believe it was. Her name is Yoram Ben Aki, 31 years old, now living in Holland. She was given up for adoption immediately after the birth. Now, you conducted this phone call with her over international phone lines late at night. It's a little bit hard to decipher exactly what she's saying, so maybe you can paraphrase a little bit for us exactly the story that she told you about how these adoption papers came about.
Basically, she said that Masuk was given a bunch of medical papers to sign and slipped into the middle of this. These papers were adoption papers that she signed, basically signing away the baby. Let's emphasize this. This is the story that she says Masuk told her. Just like Andy said that Masuk told him that the child was sold by somebody else.
So we're talking about a woman who's basically at least told two different stories to two different people.
Exactly. And we don't know for sure if either one of these stories are true. We can discern there's some commonalities in these stories, obviously. I think we could discern that, you know, perhaps this was a very traumatic experience for her. But there's some discrepancies here between the stories that were told. You know, we have Masuk's ex-husband, Andy Nolan, saying Yoram's father was married to Masuk. We have Yoram saying that she was told by Masuk, no, that she hadn't married this guy. We have Andy Nolan saying that Masuk told him that she believed that the child had been sold by somebody. We have the child himself, when we interviewed her, saying she'd never heard that. At first, she'd never heard of that story, that she thought that her mother had been tricked into signing the adoption papers. Let's really emphasize here, we don't know exactly what happened, but we know that both of these people believe what they were told by Masuk. And it's clear there's some discrepancies here. And I think that this may tell us a little bit more, inform us a little bit more about who Masuk is by the very discrepancies we see in these stories.
And we've talked a lot about Masuk's upbringing in South Korea and how some of the cultural
lifestyles that she was living at that time may have affected the way her behavior carried on in the future, some of the things that happened to her, some of the very unfortunate things that happened to her. But now let's talk a little bit about Masuk once she gets to the United States. She's married to Andy Nolan, and what happens when she comes to America?
Well, to hear Andy Nolan tell it, there was a marked change that came over Masuk once she got here to Illinois. She became extremely materialistic. There seems to be some real commonality between all the people we talked in this story, whether it's Yaram or anyone else. They all describe her as an extremely materialistic person. So I found that really curious. I mean, did just coming to America turn her into this, or what exactly were the dynamics here?
When she came to America, she just got Americanized and just loved to spend money. You know, oh, really? The only thing I got to do is use a piece of plastic. I can go in that store and get whatever I want and pay for it, you know, whenever. And so anyway, that's how a lot of it got started. Basically, she just loved to spend money. And I was on a very, very, very tight budget.
Well, when we talked earlier, you said it was $1 a day.
Correct. It was $1 a day.
Well, how on earth do you live on $1 a day, budget?
Well, like I said, she handled everything. Only thing I was allowed for was $1 a day to get 2 cans of pop when I went to work. So I, in her eyes, I didn't need money because she's the one who handled all the bills, knew what we had, so that was none of my business. Almost like a child, you know. Do you tell your child if you have any, how much money you guys have and this and this and this? You don't. So that's the way she treated me. You know, it wasn't information that I needed to know. So, therefore, she handled the financial situations. And, therefore, that's why I was given $1 a day. The way she explained it was that she would rather look like $1 million and have no money than to look average and have money. So it was all about trying to impress people about the way she looked. So, and that includes $400, $500, $600 dresses, you know, Louis Vuitton purses and coin purses and the whole ball of wax. You know, she didn't go shop at Walmart or Kmart or, you know, any of those places, or go to Goodwill or stuff like that. She wanted to name brand stuff.
But you say when she lived in Korea, she didn't try to live that way.
No, like I said, when she came to America, she got Americanized.
So that's Andy Nolan, who was married to Masuk when they had a courtship in Korea when he was in the service. They married and created a life here in Central Illinois. But Scott, that is just incredible. The lifestyle that they led, she basically controlled him, according to the way he puts it, living off $1 a day. I mean, can you imagine your wife or any spouse, it doesn't matter if it's man or woman, allowing you to live on just $1 a day? You control all the incoming finances. You control all the expenditures. The spouse doesn't need to know anything. Here's your $1 a day. That's it.
It strikes you as like, is she a control freak? What's going on here? I mean, this is like, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, what's happening? And he says, you know, that she just went through this incredible change when she got to the States. She wasn't like this in Korea. And then when she got to the United States, she just kind of became a big spender and started doing things and manipulating him in certain ways. And I mean, one of the things that he said that she would do is if she didn't get her way, she could just move back to Korea with her daughter. And that was the lever she had over him. Like, you know, you don't want to do that. Or he sounded, when I sat there with him, he just sounded absolutely desperate. Then, you know, you ever have a song go around in the back of your head while you're talking to somebody?
Oh, all the time, yeah.
When he's telling the story about how materialistic she's become and how she went through this radical change when she came to the States, I kept thinking of the song that I heard like 15 years ago when my wife and I went to see the musical Miss Saigon. And the song's about a Vietnamese immigrant aspiring to come to the United States as a refugee. And he's singing about his version of the American dream.
I'm fed up with small-time hustles. I'm too good to waste my talent for greed. I need room to flex my muscles in an ocean where the big sharks feed. Yankee. They're my family. They're selling what people need. What's that I smell in the air? The American dream. Sweet as a new millionaire. The American dream. Pre-packed and ready to wear. My American dream. Fat like a chocolate eclair. As I suck out the cream. Luck by the tail. Best of all, it's for sale, the American dream. Greasy cheese.
You know, Willis, when you talk about the American dream, there's always going to be an element of materialism in it. For some folks, it's owning a comfortable home. For others, it's having a nice car, being able to afford to send your kids to a good college. But for someone like Masuk, who was young, not well-educated, and from a different culture, the perception of the American dream, it's almost like the caricature we just listened to from Miss Saigon.
So what was life really like then for Masuk when she came to the United States?
Well, about 16 months after she came to the United States, Masuk gave birth to her daughter, Michelle. And we know that as that child grew up, there was abuse. You recall, Willis, that from an earlier episode, this is how an older Michelle described one particular beating during an interview with a Bloomington police officer.
She, you know, abused me a lot if she got mad at my dad. Or
such as? How would she abuse you?
Like a paper towel rolls. It's the wooden part. Nowadays, they don't, you know, usually use them, but a really hard wooden stick. Like, beat me, and times I would faint, you know, would just block out.
But you know, Willis, Andy Nolan, Michelle's father, and Masuk's ex-husband said he didn't realize that there was abuse going on.
I'll put it this way. You know, certain people call it abuse. Nowadays, kids are so spoiled, and a lot of them need their ass whipped. Okay, now in Korea, it's different. Now, when we were there in the 80s, late 80s, you know, kids still get their butts whipped in school. You know, I mean, with the stick, smack the hands, you know, take you outside, and kids get their ass whipped, you know, in school, you know. And it probably still goes on to this day. Punishing a child, now the Asian culture is a lot stricter than American culture. So I don't call it she was abused, but she damn sure got her share of ass whippings, and it wasn't by me.
But again, we turn to Ji-Yun Ya. She's the history professor from Northwestern University, who is also Korean-American herself. She says this is not an accurate description of typical Korean child rearing.
That is a misperception. That kind of abuse has never been accepted in Korea. Physical punishment, yes. Spankings, that kind of thing, yes. Just as it has been and in many households still is in the United States. But that kind of beating, no.
But Andy Nolan said many of the situations in which Masuk got in trouble with the law can be attributed to cultural differences.
All nationalities, you're going to have people with tempers, but I've heard from several people that they believe that the Koreans are the ones with the biggest temper.
So what do you make of that generalization there, Scott Reeder, that Koreans tend to have poor tempers?
I think it's utter nonsense, Willis. I'll be honest with you. I mean, when I was a kid, people would say that about the Irish. He's got his Irish up. He's got a temper. Come on. I mean, it's a stereotype that really doesn't have much in the basis. And, you know, in fact, I threw that question out at Professor Yeo, and she said it's not true, it's ridiculous, and it's just one of those stereotypes that's out there.
Few societies view adultery as a positive trait, and we've been talking about domestic violence here now with the beatings and whether or not Koreans are more prone to having a poor temper. But what about the whole idea of adultery?
It's a bad thing in just about every society out there. You know, some societies may be a little bit more tolerant of it than others, but nobody views that as a positive. But, you know, this is how Masuk links in with this whole story. When she was married to Andy Nolan, she began an affair with Barton McNeil, who, of course, is the father of Christina, who is now serving a 100-year sentence at Menard Correctional Center in southern Illinois for the murder of his daughter, which he contends he did not do. And since day one, essentially, he's been blaming Masuk as the person who broke into his house. But one of the things we got to remember here is how Bart and Masuk met and what her connection with the whole case is. They worked together at Red Lobster here in Bloomington. They were both married. She was married to Andy Nolan. He was married, and his wife was 9 months pregnant with Christina, and they began an affair. And that affair evolved into a 3-year relationship.
Them two fell in love, and shortly after they were together, Bart never seen a true temper that Masuk had. So once they started living together, they probably wasn't together less than a week. And he called me one night and said, "Andy, you got to help me." And I said, "Well, what's going on?" He said, "Well," he goes, "how do I control this woman? I just don't know what to do. She is crazy." And I just laughed. And I said, "Bart," I said, "you wanted her, you got her." And I said, and I just hung the phone up. And I'll never forget that. But I'm going to say probably at least, you know, maybe once a week there at first, and then it got to maybe every other week, or, you know, at least a few times a month, you know, whenever he would see me or he would call me and just say, "Please tell me, I mean, how did you put up with this?" You know, and I said, "Well, basically, I didn't talk back. So if this is what she wanted, I didn't say nothing. I just let it go. So, you know, I didn't have to worry about something getting thrown at me or her being upset."
After Masuk left her husband, Andy Nolan, and moved in with Barton McNeil, Andy said he continued to have a sexual relationship with his otherwise estranged wife.
So I'm going to ask the question, because this one's got me scratching my head a bit. You were sharing your wife with somebody else who's living with some...
But Bart didn't know that her and I was having sex.
Okay.
Let's clarify that. Bart did not know it. You know, I mean, we even had sex out in the parking lot, you know, while he was inside with Michelle and Christina, you know, out there in the parking lot there when they lived on Croxton. So, I mean, you know what, in a way I thought, you know what, you done this to me while I was with her, so I'm going to do it to you.
So, Scott, it's pretty clear that a love triangle of some sort has evolved here between Masuk and Andy Nolan and Barton McNeil, the man that she left Andy Nolan for.
This is just so weird. I'm sorry, Willis. You know, what a disappointing group. I mean, what can I say? It's just disappointing.
So let's get back to Yoram Van Oxy. She's the 31-year-old now living in the Netherlands. She was the child of Masuk, who was born in Korea and was given up the day after she was born for adoption, unwittingly, according to Masuk, and went into an orphanage and was raised by Dutch parents. What does she tell you, Scott, about Masuk's ability to love?
Well, interestingly enough, Willis, she's a psychology student, and she questions whether Masuk has the ability to love anybody. But Masuk's ex-husband, Andy Nolan, says there were positive aspects of Masuk that are often overlooked.
There's a good side to her. There's more to it than just somebody that snapped, that had a bad childhood, that killed an elderly lady. She did have a good heart.
But you know, Andy's current wife, Dawn Nolan, is not so sanguine about her husband's ex.
I think she's a narcissist. And I mean, if you kind of look up definition of narcissist, it sounds like her. In my heart of hearts, I don't necessarily know or I'm not sure about Christina, but in my heart of hearts, I think Masuk is a serial killer.
Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Dennett. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.
Hi, guys. This is Charlie from the Insight Podcast.
And this is Allie, two hosts from Two Continents.
Every week, we cover a new case from unsolved mysteries to forgotten history to crimes that changed or challenged our legal system in some way.
To get to know us and our podcast better, we recommend our episodes on Jean Spangler, Nicholas Barclay, the missing kid at the center of the documentary The Imposter, and Alison Baden Clay.
New episodes go up every Monday.
You can find us on iTunes and pretty much every other podcast app.